Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Welcome to episode 525 with my guest, Dr. Rachel Taylor. I'm Paul Gilmartin. This is the Mental Illness Happy Hour, a place for honesty about all the battles in our heads, from medically diagnosed conditions, past traumas, and sexual dysfunction to everyday compulsive negative thinking. This show's not meant to be a substitute for professional mental... Professional? Yeah, the professionals drop the R from everything that they say. This is not meant to be a substitute for professional mental counseling. I'm not a therapist. It's not a doctor's office. It's more like a waiting room that doesn't suck. The website for this show is mentalpod.com. Mentalpod, also the social media handles you can follow us at. I want to kick things off with an email that I got from Marianne. And she writes, hey there, it's Marianne. Chances are you found one of my offers or I invited you personally. Here's what I can promise you. I will only send you things that I feel will really help you out. I was so moved by this, I had to go lay down. And I don't know if I've ever held a piece of paper close to my heart before while I took a nap, but I soaked this paper with tears of gratitude. I'm just so touched that somebody who doesn't even know me would invite me to open future emails from them. Continuing, I'm a real person with a real passion for giving. People hope about changing their lives like I did. Keep your eyes open for good stuff, and good stuff is in capital letters. And I think it always should be. And I think bad stuff should be in the smallest font that you can find. As she says, it will be coming your way soon. See you then, Marianne. So deeply touched. I can't wait to click on whatever it is that you send me, Marianne. One of our sponsors for today, as always, is BetterHelp.com online counseling. That's BetterHelp.com. If you are interested in trying out online therapy, which I'm a huge fan of, as I like to say, there's nothing like crying in your recliner, not having to get in the car to cry. I really recommend checking it out. And so if you're interested, go to BetterHelp.com/mental. Make sure you include the slash mental part so they know you came from this podcast. And then you'll fill out a questionnaire. If they have a counselor that they feel is a good fit for you, they'll match you up with one. And then you can try a free week of counseling to see if it's your thing. And, you know, if you don't feel that the counselor is a good fit, they'll pair you up with another one. You need to be over 18. All right, one more thing before we get to the interview with Dr. Taylor. And for those of you that are new to the podcast is kind of two parts. One is an interview with a guest in the middle of the show, and then at the front end and the back end of the podcast are me reading things that either have been sent to me or anonymous confessions filled out by listeners on a variety of topics. And this one is from the Awfulsome Moments survey. And this was filled out by, what did they call themselves? Deeply anxious. Oh, fuck. I forgot. I used shorthand for this, and I thought I would know what my shorthand meant. But their name is something that has to do with deeply anxious. And this is actually from the psych ward experiences, but I thought this qualified as an awfulsome moment. So I'm just going to read it. The first day in the inpatient was the worst. When I first went to the hospital, I had to undress to my underwear, in the parentheses, no bra, in front of two female security guards for a, quote, skin check to see if I had any injuries. I suppose this could be to check for evidence of self-harm, but it sounded more as a protective measure of the hospital against being sued for injuries. Later, when I saw the psychiatrist to be evaluated, a different security guard escorted me to the room and sat in the room with the psychiatrist sitting behind a desk and computer. While I tried not to cry as the psychiatrist, in a sympathetic but still clinical voice, asked me about suicidal ideation, etc., I felt very exposed having to admit to suicidal thoughts. I usually can sidestep these, but I was so upset there was no way I could. And to talk about my personal history and how bad my depression had gotten. The kicker was when, in the middle of all this, the security guard fell asleep and started to quietly snore.
I just wanted to get the fuck away from my life.
You know, I couldn't have felt any lower.
Grief, guilt, shame.
Why wasn't I born a girl?
There's a switch that gets flipped in my head.
I'm supposed to be a girl.
I experience being treated like an animal.
How can a just God...
I have a vomit fetish.
...let humans do this to each other?
Help!
I fucking flew over the cuckoo's nest.
My wife's losing it.
I thought it was all about me.
I don't know what to do.
I would have committed suicide if I could have watched my funeral.
A Polaroid I found of my mother, naked in a dentist chair.
And my body doesn't quite...
I think I did 8 days in L.A. County Jail.
...fit how I see myself.
What was it all for? Why are my friends dead?
Everything that I did...
There's a comfort in the scars for me.
...was in service of OCD.
You've already had all the paper cuts. Step away from the paper.
It's really hard to see the picture when you're inside the frame.
You know, it takes a larger view to see your life.
Just actually have somebody listen to you.
Yeah. And I got up and got my tooth and left.
I am here with Rachel Taylor, who's a physician, and our paths crossed a couple of weeks ago, and you were so open and honest about your life. I was like, wow, she would be a great guest, and you you agreed. Your mistake. Boy, will you come to regret this.
I doubt it, but thank you.
Yeah, you know, you're based on the East Coast, and how long have you been a practicing physician?
I finished medical school in 2011, okay. And I did a couple of years of surgery training and decided to switch to family medicine, and then did 2 years of emergency medicine with Native Americans. And now I do primary care. There's a lot of travel. And so
talk
a big
about
part that. Of my story actually is the Native Americans. I know you're very,
I was just going to say, let's get to that right after we talk about your upbringing. I'd love to start there if you're cool with that. I don't know why you wouldn't be cool with it. I'd prefer I want to do the podcast, but I would prefer not to talk about anything from my childhood.
No, I'm totally fine. I wasn't sure if you wanted me to put into context remembering my sexual abuse trauma as recently as I did, or if you want me to tell you that it happened, like start with that having happened, because I think a big part of my story is having not known that happened until more recently.
Well, I think that's such an important part of the story, because I also, until I was, you know, very middle-aged, did not realize really up until about 10 years ago that what happened to me was sexual abuse, and the perpetrator was my mom. And it was very kind of hidden in caring for the child's body. And well, let's talk about
What was the emotional kind of, give me some snapshots of childhood.
Yeah, let's do this. Okay, so I grew up in a very strongly Mormon family. And so
you grew up in Utah?
So part of my childhood was in a small town in northern Utah. My parents got divorced when I was very young. I was two, youngest of four kids at that time. My dad is also a physician. He was in training when they had me and then got divorced shortly thereafter, after me. We moved to northern Utah when I was about two until the age of 11. And at which time my mom did this thing that I call surprise husband. Where she had met someone on the earliest of dating sites, an LDS singles Mormon dating site. And I think I was at my dad's, for the week, and I got home and my mom's like, I'm married. We're moving to California. So then I grew up
wow.
Southern California. Mm-hmm. From the age of 11 to 16.
Do you remember what you felt or thought when she was, I'm married?
Yeah. So here's the, I mean, we've already kind of opened this can of saying we both had a sexual trauma that we didn't remember until we were in middle age. Right. So I think one of the great, this sounds crazy, but one of the better things about the sexual trauma is, you know, you kind of get, unknowingly stuck in that kind of maturity of age. Right. Mm-hmm. Which is not great in some ways. Like, I wish I had known that about it before, you know, but I think the great thing was that I was very kind of, for my whole life, very open. I very, very much, very childlike in those positive characteristics too. Very willing to give people a chance, very seeing the good in people. In some ways, trusting people I definitely should not have trusted in my life. But you know, so when we were moving to California, I was excited. I thought, this is funny, my goal was, so first of all, I've never wanted to be anything but a doctor, or anything. I've always wanted to be a doctor, at least, I guess I should say. But I was so excited. I'm like, we're moving to Southern California. I could be an actress. And I said, I'm going to be an actress, but for backup, I'm going to become a doctor, is what I told my parents. Just in case actressing doesn't work out, I'll become a doctor.
And why wouldn't
fall
it?
Back on?
Why wouldn't it work out? Everybody that comes here has their dreams encouraged and realized. And there's no bitterness, sadness, or darkness.
Right, right. We're all stars. Mm-hmm. So I was actually very excited.
We're
my mom
in
married in. So I grew up in, so I say I grew up in Southern California from 11 to 16. And I think, I mean, that was not a long time. I skipped two grades, 6th and 12th. So those were years I should have been still in California, if that makes sense. But I was, the home situation was very volatile. I hate to say, you know, like my stepdad was awful, because I think we all come to life, you know, come to the table with our own traumas.
Yeah.
So
it's something that's discussed a lot here. And I, you know, by prefacing that, I think we all understand that you're not throwing him under the bus, that there were positive qualities there. And this isn't a total summation of him as a human being, but these are the things that happened.
Right. Absolutely. Yes. So it was a very kind of volatile home. I remember, you know, just like you'd imagine some repressed religious home where no one talked about the bad things. And it was everything pretended everything was fine until it wasn't. And then it just was an explosion and it was terrifying. And I remember him yelling at my mom and me as the youngest standing up and be like, don't talk to my mom that way. And just kind of having to defend my mom and, you know, wondering why she wasn't defending us, you know, in hindsight, she didn't really have that capability, but, just kind of scary. You know, there was one event where we were taken over to our neighbor's house by my mom when we first moved out there with a man none of us really knew that well, including her. And left there at our the top person, like a pastor in the Mormon church, is called the bishop. So left at our bishop's house while we waited for him to calm down, and not knowing like what, you know, what's happening. And then my mom picks us up and take us back, and no one talks about it. There's no discussion about what happened. Right. And I just, you know, I remember my life kind of spent chronic overachieving because I think with that many kids, so he has three kids. So then add that and my half brother that was born from my dad's new marriage. So there are eight of us. So for me to get attention, you know, just this constant kind of, excuse me, overachieving, you know, the first person in my class to be varsity lettered in high school, and, you know, being in the audition show choir and being the best Mormon girl I could possibly be. And, you know, just this kind of constant, what can I achieve so that I'll get some attention in this family?
What do you remember it feeling like in your body back then? Do you remember feeling tense? Do you remember having stomach aches or dread or fear? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So a lot of what I did was, I remember quite a few things. So I was not very good at sleeping. I can't remember ever sleeping well. I have a pulled muscle in my right back. I remember it was an especially stressful day and I was getting ready to run on a track meet. And, as the gun went off, you know, to go, I went to run and it pulled, but I don't, like, in hindsight, that the muscle strain, you know, the different pains, I would break down just crying over things that that my friends would be like, why is she crying? You know, why is she crying?
Did you stop the race
when I was running?
Yeah. Did you stop the race because of your back?
No. I kept going. I think
that tells a lot. That tells a lot.
Right. So I think just this chronic stress, this chronic kind of not sleeping would really culminate for me in crying a lot at times where I finally felt safe. And it was usually at night in my room alone or, you know, with one of my best friends or something. And actually, interestingly enough, if you don't know this, there's a paper called The Science of Tears that show that tears released, you know, during sadness releases a lot of stress hormones. So essentially my own body was taking care of all the stress by crying. And, you know, it just felt very tense. It felt very, very defensive, kind of always with my guard up, kind of always on edge. This is a funny story. I guess I asked my mom to take me to a therapist and she took me to one when I think I was 12, asked her to, and they made me draw pictures or something. And I was like, that was really stupid, mom. That was like for babies. I'm not going back again. So, you know, if that just speaks to my house, like it was so busy that the 12-year-old has to ask for her own therapy, you know? I think that was a time when I just really longed, I think, for connection. And when I look back, I see myself kind of reaching for friendships that were not great, but I would cling to anyone that would give me the chance of being their friend because I felt just so alone, you know, and so scared. As I made friends later, I was so grateful. Like I wouldn't have gone through all of that.
Isn't that the best feeling when you do finally meet your people, no matter how late in life it is, it's such a good feeling. And you look back sometimes at your previous friendships and you're like, wow, I was eating crumbs and thought it was a banquet.
Yeah, absolutely. And, this is really funny. About 4 to 5 months ago, one of my friends, quote unquote friends from seventh grade, sent me this long message on Facebook. She found me saying, I'm so sorry, the type of friend I was and things like that. So it's interesting, you know, how that really comes back around. But I mean, I'm not, I'm not a perfect friend either. You know, I'm not always, but
I think one of the most important things in friendship is just a willingness to own your own shit. Cause you're both going to disappoint each other. You're both going to, you know, have moments when you're a human being or, you know, even lose your temper and say something really shitty, but how you clean it up to me is what determines, do I want to hang in for this friendship?
Yeah. Oh my God. Absolutely. I think pretending, and this is a conversation I had with my 13-year-old the other day. I said, pretending like you're never going to get mad at your friends, your spouse, your boyfriend, or whatever you have, you know, that is a way of kind of, I guess, to me, a way I have used to shame myself in the past. Like when I get angry, get so mad at myself, like, what, you weren't even ladylike, you're such an awful person, you know, this dialogue in my head about how can you get mad at these people that love you and whatever. And honestly, you know, I think we have a misunderstanding about how friendships and relationships go. It's the aftermath of the fight, not the fight that really determines, you know, your capabilities as a friend and to receive friendship too, I think.
So what would, if you could get in a time machine and go back to yourself at any age and have adult you talk to young you, when would it be and what, if anything, would you say or do? I know that's a big question.
That is a huge question. I almost wonder if I would go back and say, hey, listen, you know how you're responding? This is because of a sexual assault. You were sexually assaulted when you were young and you don't remember, but your body does. And that's why this is so, so difficult for you. But I don't know. I mean, it's a hard thing to do, right? Because if I were to do that, what experience would I have missed in my life? You know, where I think that sexual assault really brought on a lot of just searching and determination for truth in my life and kind of will to survive, and maybe it would have been nice to not be in survival mode my whole life.
Right.
But
mostly I mean for temporary comfort, you know?
Oh, right. Yeah. I mean, absolutely. I would go back and just say, listen, it's going to get better. Keep on keeping on. And I think at that time in my life, if talking about the sexual assault was off the table, I would really tell myself, hone your intuition, forget everyone else and start meditating, start listening to yourself, start, you know, all of this, because that has been so, so pivotal in my life now for my healing and health is my own intuition. So.
I love it. So what's the next chapter for you after that?
Okay. So then I left high school when I was 16, I did early college. I moved to Utah where my dad still was, and went to college from 16 to 20. And then again, you know, the chronic overachieving, did a lot of, you know, honors in microbiology and pre-med and a minor in chemistry and just such a nerd.
How did you do in organic chemistry?
Oh my God. I actually liked organic chemistry.
Oh,
so
my
ultra
God.
Nerdy. I know. I loved building the little models and stuff like that. I'm a very hands-on type person and very spatially oriented.
I always thought I was smart, and then I took organic chemistry and I was like, wow. I could never grasp it. Could never grasp it. But it clicked with you.
Yeah. Well, so here's probably the difference between us though. I love being spatial, like models and things like that. Math though, like I need a spatial model to look at for me. So math was not easy for me. Organic chemistry and all of that, biochemistry was super interesting. I love that.
For me, it felt like Tetris times 10, like Tetris in three dimensions. And then they're like, oh, and there's also all these exceptions to the rule. The thing I loved about inorganic chemistry was there was no exceptions.
Right. That's very true. I think one of the reasons I loved organic chemistry was because I took both parts one and two during this intensive summer course where you had 4 hours of lecture a day. And I didn't have any other classes to worry about. And I got really close to two friends that we would study together you know, the whole thing. So that whole summer. So I think in some ways it reminds me of those great friendships, and maybe I've blocked some of how hard it was. So.
What were your escapes other than achieving, or was that it? Was that your kind of sole obsession?
Okay. So here's my thing. And a lot of people saw it as like boy crazy was what they were telling me. I wouldn't necessarily like run around having like one night stands or anything like that. I was, I guess, relatively kind of innocent. I didn't really drink. I got drunk one time when I was 15 and my mom was.
You're a terrible person.
I know. Unbelievable, right? And then in like once I went to college, I was never legal drinking age in college. So I drank here occasionally, but here's what happened. I went to college in Utah where men were looking to marry young women, Mormon women, right? So when I was 13 in California, I remember sitting in a church sermon or whatever you want to call it. And they talked about, I loved my friend so much that I wanted to share the Mormon church with him. You know, like my friend was amazing, but he would have been better with being Mormon. And I remember at 13 years old, I was like, that's not okay.
Yeah.
If this God person, whoever loves everyone, why does he care what religion you are?
Right.
You know, like it's still, anyway.
That's a pretty awesome thought for a kid at that age.
Right. I wish at that age I would have gone back and said, keep on that line, like keep on that learning how to love and that kind of thing. But anyway, so I wasn't Mormon or practicing when I moved to Utah for college, and then met a couple of guys who I ended up getting really close with. One of them really liked me, was almost 10 years older than me. And you know, we dated for a year or so, and my family was like, we really love him, you should get married. And me wanting to people please, me wanting to be accepted by my own family, was like, okay, I guess so. I guess this is what I do, you know? And so at 19, as a teenager, I got married the first time. And so needless to say, about, I'd say 6 months to a year afterwards, and I feel terrible about this. I mean, I wish I'd had the insight beforehand. I was like, what did I do? I don't believe in this church. I don't want to be, I was applying to medical school at the time, and this man knew that and was supportive until we got married. Then he decided, I don't want you to go to medical school. Actually, I want you to be like, why don't you just get a master's or something? And I'm like, excuse me, you know, like, this is my only dream. And so, you know, between that and kind of waking up one day and being like, what the fuck did I do? Excuse my language. I just, that was that. And then, you know, so we got divorced, and at the time, again, difficulty sleeping, my big escapes, I actually worked night shift as a nurse assistant while I'd take like 20 credits a semester, and I'd sleep like pretty rarely, like I, you know, whenever I could, in between tests and stuff like that, in between classes. So, yeah, I guess more like probably work and studying were all my escapes. Like I would just load myself up with tasks. And my family kind of, I remember my dad saying, who's going to take care of you now? You know, these are the kind of messages I got. Who's going to take care of you? And this isn't a good time. I remember that. This isn't a good time for you to be getting divorced. Like for him. It was inconvenient for my dad.
Oh, he was saying for him.
For him. This is not a good time for him.
Wow. That says a lot. That says a tremendous, tremendous amount.
Oh my God. So just a lot of, you know, kind of disappointing my family. My family kind of, this feeling of them kind of stepping away or distancing themselves because I wasn't kind of fitting in that mold that they wanted me to be in, and me keeping trying to fit into the mold, and then just waking up every time and being like, I can't do this. I can't compromise myself to fit what my family or whatever social circle wants me to be.
Yeah. It's such a difficult thing that so many people never do, detaching, you know, even with love from people that are not healthy for you, or distancing yourself. There's so much guilt involved, and there's usually such a circle of other family members who reinforce that message that you're a bad person for doing this. Why don't you just do it? And I don't know if subconsciously in their mind, they don't want to face their own dislike of the system that they are just acquiescing to, but it's really hard. It's one of the most common emails I get from listeners, is they'll just talk about, I don't know what to do with my family. They, you know, I'm afraid to come out to them, or I'm afraid to do what I really want to do. And it's fucking hard. It's fucking hard.
You feel so free. That actually didn't come until I was about 30. Me doing that. But,
and at what point had you kind of, severed the, at least emotional tie that you had to them and wanting their approval?
It actually wasn't until probably 3 to 4 years ago, in my early 30s, that I was like, it wasn't until the magical time I spent with, not only the Native Americans, but some of the indigenous people that embrace their indigenous, like, traditional healing. And we could definitely,
let's talk about that.
You want to talk about it? You want to jump forward? There's a lot though in between. Okay. We could jump.
Well, let's as they say, put a pin in it and make sure we don't forget to go there, because I am interested in hearing about your experiences.
Oh, that is the highlight of the story, but we could get through some of this. I'll just, you know, briefly say, you know, it kind of was a lot of chaos. I think I was looking, searching, right?
In your 20s, you're talking about?
Right, yes. After this divorce, you know, I was so buried in my work and trying to become a doctor and you know, looking for things, and then, you know, became pregnant about a year later, got married to this person because my family wanted me to, even though I was vehemently opposed until I was like, fine. And then the stakes become higher, right? This becomes someone who's throwing things at me, who's screaming names at me, who's angry at me because I'm studying. He's like, you think you're so fucking smart, you know, you stupid, like, you bitch, you think you're so much better than me. Like, talk about someone else's insecurity. And, you know, I had just had my daughter and I was like, that's enough. I can't do this. I wasn't sleeping at the time. I was having difficulty. I was irritable, you know, all of this. And guess what happened? I got misdiagnosed as bipolar. No one was asking me, do you feel safe at home? What's going on at home? No, it was this, you know, and the doctors, as a doctor, I can say, we try our best, but it was a huge miss. You know, there was no asking about domestic assault, about, are you able to sleep? Do you feel safe at home to sleep? You know, and this is in my first year of medical school, and now I'm finding random people to watch my daughter and, you know, feeling like I'm the problem, right? This,
wow.
I can't sleep. I'm stressed out. I mean, yeah, like, welcome to being a medical student and a new parent and an abusive relationship. Like, you know, like, no one normalized that for me. And I wish at the time someone had been like, look, yeah, we know why you're not sleeping. You got this asshole yelling at you. You have a baby crying and you're in medical school. Like, this is nuts. You know, who do you think you are? Basically, you superwoman, you know?
Do you ever look at the fact that your mom chose someone like that and then you did the same thing and wonder, was that a subconscious thing? Was that the type of man that I was just familiar with? What do you ask yourself when you look at that? And please don't interpret this as me victim blaming.
No, because I agree with you, Paul. I think too few times we look at our patterns and who we choose. Because I was assaulted by another boyfriend later, who I lived with. So, and then, you know, someone, and then just a lot of these very chaotic relationships. And over time, you know, I blamed myself for a long time. You know, I was misdiagnosed as bipolar for almost 10 years. In that time, I had used alcohol to cope with increasing stressors. I was a surgical resident initially. I missed my daughter. She was with her dad because I was blamed. She wasn't like pried from my hands. I thought I was this crappy, like bipolar mom who can't handle a baby. You know, I never did anything wrong. There was, you know, there was no abuse. There's, you know, of the child.
Did you have visitation rights?
Yeah, no. Yeah. Okay. It was agreed upon that he would have her. There was no reason for me to not have full custody of her, except for when you're in medical school, you do 30 hour shifts at the hospital. I lived on $16,000 a year. So I wasn't paying a full time nanny to watch my daughter, you know, when I'm in the hospital for 30 hours. And so he had like some disabled vet stuff. So he had the GI Bill. He didn't have to work this whole time, lived on his disability, which is great. That's great, you know, but it just was so hard thinking I'm bipolar, getting medicated, going to school and these crazy hours where you're up at night and, you know, going to therapy, trying to figure out what's wrong with me. Why am I so awful? Why are the medications not working? Why can't I focus? You know, just wow. A whole bunch of, you know, asking what's wrong with me. And then again, being in these kind of chaotic relationships with men and the whole time just thinking, what the fuck is wrong with me? Like, it seems like everyone else can kind of do this stuff. You know what I mean? Like, it seems like everyone else kind of has it together. What's wrong with me? Like, why can't I just have this like healthy, calm relationship, you know?
And the irony is that then you see patients every day who put you on a pedestal, and not saying that you don't deserve people's admiration for being a doctor. I think it's an incredibly noble thing to do, but they look at you as somebody that has no problems, that copes easily with life, and that is never stressed out, and you got it all figured out.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you should have heard when I was on the reservation. I would hear literally these exact words: "You stupid white bitch! You have no idea. You've never had a struggle. You don't even know." And you know, sometimes I'll
directed at you in the hospital,
directly to me as their ER doctor. Oh. "You stupid fucking white bitch! I'm gonna fucking punch you in the face. You have no idea," just screaming at me. You know, and first of all, I do have to say, the greater the knowledge I get of the injustices done to the Native Americans, like, I get it. As you might know already, PTSD creates a change in our DNA called methylation. So any PTSD, so like if you see something terrible, that creates that change in your DNA. And then it now has been shown by science, it can be passed down for up to 7 generations. So the Native Americans are still... and apply to whoever you want to, but people are still living in that methylation, that change in DNA from generational trauma. So for her to extra hate me, I got it. I was like, I get it. This is literally in your DNA to hate me right now. And I get that. Like, and you can see it. And so I didn't really take it personally. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But I did sit down with them and I'd say, listen, I've been there. I have been assaulted. I have been whatever. I have been, you know, you name it. I have used alcohol to cope. I get that. I needed help too. I couldn't figure out what the problem was and I needed help, and I've been there and I'm here to help you. A lot of times the walls would come down and kind of, oh, wow.
Go ahead, finish your thought and then give me an example of, if you can remember one.
So Oh, I was going to say there was a sign in front of the hospital in one of the reservations I went to still that said, kill the white man, when I started working there. So, and I wasn't really allowed to be out on the reservation at night or anything like that. Like I had to.
For your own safety.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So an example of, I'm not sure exactly what an example of you wanted me to give you.
Of their walls coming down.
Oh, a lot of what will happen is usually there's drugs or alcohol involved. So let's just say this is not like a baseline, you know, coming in with just hating me. But.
And untreated, as you know, untreated alcoholism and drug addiction warps the person suffering from it. It warps their perspective in a way that to say it's profound, it might even be an understatement.
Yeah, absolutely. So there was one patient, I remember, he came in just, you know, we have in the ER or in any hospital setting, you have like frequent flyers. You have people that are there all the time. I have frequent flyers, not a very nice name for them, but, you know, they're there all the time and almost always for the same reason and almost always involves drinking too much or withdrawals or drugs or, you know, something like that. I think that the Western medicine system gets it wrong in seeing that this is a moral failure on this person's part, which I think is ridiculous.
Super fucked.
Right? Yeah. So fucked. That is a great way to put it. And it was, you know, just as an aside, it's a very, very difficult to live in to work in a culture that sees, you know, alcohol or even some mental health issues as like a moral failure and have those issues. Like I didn't tell anyone I was bipolar, quote unquote bipolar at the time.
Right.
So anyway, I see this patient and he comes in and everyone's like, oh, he's always here, you know, whatever. So I'm like, you know what? This time I'm going to take a breath. I'm going to tap into my own problems, my own issues, what I wish would have happened. When I, you know, had these problems and, I go to him and I'm like, listen, I know that you are so ashamed and, you know, so tired of drinking over and over, you know, and not knowing why you can't stop. And I explained to him the DNA, the trauma in the DNA and how, that could potentially be an issue. And, told him about, you know what, I struggled with alcohol. Here's what I did. And it's not easy. You have to face the underlying problem, but you can do it too. And this doesn't mean you're a bad person or, you know, you're a failure, because I think a lot of defensiveness and anger comes from that sadness or that place of shame or guilt or something like that. And he, you know, ended up actually like breaking down crying, probably releasing those stress tears and then saying, you know, thank you. Like I was seen as a human being today. And I think that's, you know, the benefit of having been through so much bullshit in my life is really to say, yep, I have been here. I have 100% been here. I'll tell you my story if you tell me yours and we can come together as a team.
It's such a powerful thing when that pile of bullshit gets turned into gold that you can spend in connecting to another person. That's what led me to believe that there is some benevolent force in the universe that I can't explain. I don't know how it works, but I feel it in those moments. I feel it. And that must be what other people call God. I'm sometimes uncomfortable using that word because it has, as you know, kind of been
sometimes used in a way that is more harmful to another human being. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I agree. I can explain some of it actually, Paul. There's a lot of science behind intuition and the Heart Math Institute just published a whole book on the science of the heart. And I was just reading it because I have nothing cooler to do on a Friday night than to read scientific studies. But your electromagnetic field of one person can coordinate with another person's electromagnetic fields of their heart. We read that on EKGs. That's what the electromagnetic field, you know, the squiggly EKGs.
Right. You're right.
That actually can coordinate also with someone else's EEGs, so their brainwaves. There are now studies proving it. This was some of my big talk I told you I just spoke at the Physician Burnout Symposium, was about the different ways that intuition works, and the different ways that there's a concept called emotional contagion. Have you ever heard of that?
I don't think so, no.
So emotional contagion is something coined, I think, in the 70s by a psychologist, where it's basically like someone's having a shitty day, your boss or whatever, they come in and for whatever reason, the whole office is in a bad mood, right? They coined that phrase, and since then there's been a lot of work on it. So the person, and I am blanking on her name, but actually all of these studies, by the way, are in the book I wrote. So if you're more interested, they're all cited in there.
Mention the name of your book again.
It's called Medication Detox, How to Live Your Best Health. And this book is about like intuition and like free ways to be healthy, because the thing that drives me in medicine is serving underserved populations. I always told people, if there wasn't student loans, I would literally just do medical missions only. I'm more than happy to, if organizations with underserved populations that you know, can't pay for this kind of thing, want help, I am more than willing to volunteer my time, because I think it's so important that people know how very healthy we can be with literally spending no money if we just know what to do with our bodies. And this is not recipes or supplements. This is talking about our electromagnetic fields and how they interact, and how one person's brain waves will coordinate with another person's heart just within 18 inches of them. And the HeartMath Institute has found something called coherence. So they measure heart rate variability. And what that can show is if you amplify it, it shows if you're in like an angry mood versus like a loving, coherent, kind mood. It can show a difference in your heart electromagnetic field. And so if we can tell from our EKG what kind of mood we're in, right? And then within 18 inches of someone, you can use your EKG, your heart electromagnetic field, can coordinate with their brain electromagnetic fields. And actually, like, they will coordinate together. And in some ways, I think it's part of the unspoken kind of way that your mood changes. Now, there's also the mirror neuron system. Women use that a lot to pick up how people are doing emotionally by looking at their faces. We use that a ton. Men do briefly, but then they go into like problem solving mode, which is a different part of your brain. And actually, mirror neurons, not only, so one of the studies they used was in monkeys, where they looked at their brain while one monkey was observing the other. The other monkey would like get a banana, peel it and eat it or whatever, or get a banana and throw it away or whatever they do, right? The other monkey is staying still, but watching this monkey do it, the same exact neurons are lighting up. So that's what a mirror neuron is. I'm mirroring what you're doing, which is another way we pick up emotions too.
And probably the reason why advertising works.
Oh my God. That's why they show babies on advertising, I'm sure. Same with facial mimicry. But the incredible thing in this, in the monkey studies, is that they watched the monkey who was observing know what the other monkey was going to do with the banana before he did it, based on the mirror neurons. Basically, he could tell the other monkey's intention and not the actual movement. So before the other monkey threw the banana away, the observing monkey already knew he was going to do that. And this is all, like, there's so much science of intuition. It's nuts. Like, it's just so nuts to me that we don't spread the word on all of this, because these are all things that can kind of be part of this emotional contagion. And this is a big thing I actually teach. I do intuitive. So as you know, I work right now with the pandemic. I'm still doing a lot of generic, typical primary care. But I also do a lot of, I call it intuitive health education, where it's like, here's all of the science. Let me help with my intuition. look at you and without talking, because I don't want, I don't want someone to tell me what they're thinking or feeling, because I don't want to be biased. I want to look and say, okay, we're discovering some stuck beliefs here. These are areas that we can work. I use my own, like, over the years and through teachings from both the Native Americans and non-Native Americans, I've learned how to use these modalities that are scientifically proven to help other people overcome their kind of stuckness in things.
Wow. That's some cool shit. Like,
it's so fucking cool. Like, I could talk about this forever.
Are you anti-med for people's mental issues?
No.
Okay. So I just wanted to clear that up.
No, I know. You know, the book is called Medication Detox, and in hindsight, I'm like, maybe it sends the wrong message. I guess what I'm trying to say with this book is we can be so healthy. And this was shown to me actually by the Native Americans, who you would just not typically think, some of them with some of their lifestyles, would be healthy at all. But you find, or I would find, it was there were a few, just as one example, there was one medicine man from the reservation who hadn't seen a doctor in like 30, 40 years. And came in with some chest pains, and we did EKGs, like all the labs, everything, all of that. And I literally have never seen more beautiful labs in my life. Perfect labs, right? Super healthy, like everything was fine, right? And it was kind of amazing. This man lived, you know, his life with intention, with an appreciation for the earth, with presence, with being there, finding his own peace, going slowly, like that kind of thing, being intentional about who he surrounds himself with, and, you know, running Sweat Lodge and doing all of those kind of really beautiful self-care and sometimes very hard and deep self-work activities. And, you know, we talked for quite a while and, you know, it just, it was kind of incredible. You know, we came down to figuring out together what it was that was driving this chest pain. And I think it just takes an openness on both people's parts to figure that out. But it is and it was not a physical thing you could see, right? Mm-hmm. But there's so much research on the unseen. However, when it comes to medications, back to that, sorry. I think the medications are a great stabilizer. I think they're a great stabilizer. If you can't, it's like ER surgeries, things like that. If it's something that keeps you alive or that helps stabilize you in life while you're fixing the thing that caused the initial issue.
Right. It's kind of a life raft rather than the boat and the island.
I guess so. I'm not sure.
Meaning it keeps you from sinking, but it's not ultimately the only thing that you need to tool you need to utilize to get where you want, you know.
Exactly.
You need trauma work, possibly. You need to eat right. You need to have community. You need to live with purpose and intention and try to be present and et cetera, et cetera.
I think one of the big things we're missing is honing and really appreciating all of the unseen that exists. And that's kind of my mission, is to spread that word. But I can give you, so kind of going back just a little bit. So here I was still thinking I was bipolar in 2016, which, by the way, was the same year I got assaulted by one of my boyfriends, and then moved out only to be in an apartment where someone, a stranger, tried to walk in and attempted to sexually assault me. So it was just not a year, wow. Not my year. Just these repeated patterns too, that, you know, now I can look back and say, oh, well, that makes sense why I chose that, but I'm choosing not to do that anymore, type of thing, and fighting that chaos. So in that time, when I was a family medicine resident, actually a couple of psychiatrists had been like, I don't think you're bipolar. And it's so funny. I was so afraid to feel that. I was like, no, I am. Keep me on all these medications. Like, I was insisted on staying on the medications because I was so afraid of what my emotions would do if I wasn't on them. So kept me on. I was going, I graduated and I was flying around to different reservations. I was probably on 10-ish medications a day, different medications, and some of them to treat the side effect of the other medication. And there was a lot. One big problem was that I had a low thyroid, so that was hard to control too, but that's something that should have been discovered right after my pregnancy, but hadn't been discovered for years afterwards, which led to a lot of my depression actually. I was going to the reservations. I was seeing a therapist. I was working. I was taking all my meds and doing, quote, everything right according to Western medicine. And then, I'm on the reservation, and that's when it hit me. And in 2018, I was like, when I leave the shift, I'm going to go kill myself. Like, that's it. I'm done. I'm exhausted. I feel so hopeless. My daughter doesn't even care about me in my head, my story I made up. You know, everyone else would be better off without me. I'm too emotional, you know, all this stuff. And, you know, it's what you're talking about. You can't explain it. There was something in me that said, you need to fight for your life. Like, you're not done. You're not done here. You have so much to do, right? And, I came home and just kind of devastated, and I went to this place I frequented. And these girls who knew me were like, oh, you know, Dr. Taylor, already back from the reservation. I'm like, oh, for whatever reason, I was like, in my head, I'm just going to be super open with these guys. I'm like, actually, you guys, I'm suicidal. I needed to come home. I needed help. It was frowned upon. My boss was very mean about it. Very mean, very shaming, kind of, what? Look at what you've done. You've left your post. These patients are without you. We might lose this contract. So That's how medicine, that's very common for medicine. Super common in the medical field. So when I got home from the reservation, I was barely clinging to life. And it was kind of like I have fucking nothing to lose anymore. I'm doing everything right. Supposedly I'm doing everything I was asked to do. And I still don't want to be alive. Like, this is terrible. But keep in mind, we see a lot of suicidal patients in the emergency room. That's the first place you go. And that's great. I think we need to have a safe place. And for now, that's the best we have, right, is the emergency room. So that's fine. But I was seeing 2, 3, 4 suicidal patients daily. And in the context of that facial mimicry and all of that I just told you about, you could imagine why some of the suicidal thoughts may not have all been mine. In hindsight, I saw that, but I went to this, it was a cold press juice place, and these girls were like, oh, you're back early, Dr. Taylor from the reservation. I'm like, yeah, guys, I'm suicidal. I had nothing to lose. Right. I just someone had to have an answer for me because I was doing everything I thought I was supposed to be doing. Right. There had to be more. There had to be something else. Or I literally had a plan just to kill myself. I couldn't find something else. I was ready. I was just so done. And so I, for whatever reason, one of the girls who usually works at a different location was there doing inventory or something. She's like, I know who can help you. This guy, George, right? So George, unbeknownst to me. So she's like, he does this, you know, indigenous like healing stuff and whatever. Legal, by the way, not like some crazy whatever. So I call George, and it's insane, right? So I was working with the natives. I loved, I was honored to work with them. I mean, there was so much beauty there on the reservations. And it turned out this person, he and his wife were both Native Americans and lived in Phoenix. And also George was a physician assistant that was trained at Yale. So very smart, who introduced me actually first to that methylation of the DNA, the way that we react in our bodies when trauma happens and how it's passed down. And, you know, I really think I would not have gotten that big step between because I was pure science, like, I don't believe you, you know, show me by study, blah, blah, blah. If it hadn't been for him being able to do that, I don't think I would be where I'm at now, in the sense of like awakening to like our electromagnetic fields and intuition and how it's a real scientifically shown thing, you know? And at the time, you know, we were just chatted for a while, and he introduced me to all of these concepts. He's like, I think you're just really sensitive to all of this stuff, the facial mimicry and all that. He's like, I don't think you're bipolar. And I was like, really? Because other people have been saying that too, you know? Like, it was weird, like the story that I created that I had to be bipolar because something was so wrong with me. But they did. This was really funny. So I was there. We talked for a long time. I developed a beautiful relationship with them. And I think that relationship was the beginning of the needing approval from my family, because that was the first time I felt home with people who I was not blood related to, but in a very peaceful kind of connected way. That was not this chaos that I grew up in. And so,
you felt safe and seen.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And so George is going back to become a naturopath because he had some of the same sentiments I feel about Western medicine, is that we don't treat kind of the unseen, the holistic side, you know, of things. I think Western medicine, again, has its part for sure. So I don't mean to
surgery,
say that,
stuff like that, you know.
Yeah, mental health. This past year, I use an antidepressant to get through part of the pandemic. Like, you know, it's not like, oh my God, I really dislike when people are like, that's toxic or that's toxic. Like, everyone calm down. Like, if it works for you, great, go for it, you know? So anyway, I sat there and George was like, we're going to do something called pranic healing, which is like an energy work thing. And I crossed my arms and I looked at him and he's like, don't worry, it works even if you don't believe in it. Like, he knew I was being this like obstinate asshole about it, like whatever. And then they did it. And for reasons I can't explain, I have never again felt suicidal in my life. And that was something I struggled with. Like, a few times during residency, I was suicidal. So, and life wasn't like magically easier either. Like, it was still the same, but I just never again thought of killing myself as an option. And that's really what set me off to looking at the science and, whoa, like, holy shit. You know, I've been on medical missions and seeing these underserved populations who can't afford, you know, all the doctor's visits and, you know, medicines and stuff like that. And it really set me off on this. How can we be healthy without this or that supplement or this or that, eating this or that, or having this kind of gym, or, you know, all the stuff that is just not accessible to a great majority of the world's population that deserve to be healthy, by the way. And I just have seen more and more of this unseen electromagnetic fields, and the more we kind of hone and fix our stuck beliefs. As you might know, the body remembers. So, you know, getting to more recent times, this was actually only 6 months ago now. About 8 months ago, I dated some guy who was like 2 weeks long. He wasn't that great, but I was like devastated, right? And I'm like, what the fuck is this? Like, what is this? This guy is not that great. Why am I so like just clinging like this, these abandoned, you know? And then, you know, through my meditation and all this kind of stuff and listening to my intuition, I kind of got this, okay, abandonment issues. Okay. And then I looked at this book. I was working on abandonment issues. I decided for this, I was going to get I'd done a bunch of brain scans, by the way, a couple of years ago for a custody hearing, which never happened, by the way. Ugh. But anyway, the blessing was I got a bunch of brain scans that showed PTSD and not bipolar disorder. And it's this big battery of testing through this place called the Amen Clinic that does a bunch of mental health. that people will fly in to really get a better diagnosis if they feel frustrated with what's going on, or they're not getting better or whatever. So that was, you know, another drop in the bucket of you're not bipolar. We'd already decided that before I got the PTSD diagnosis, but that was a little more relieving, I guess, to feel I was on the right track. So about 6 months ago, I was doing this abandonment issues work, and one of the exercises was visiting your inner child almost daily. And in meditation every morning, I get up, okay, inner child, what do you need? And a lot of times it would be like rocking or, you know, whatever, just needing hugs or whatever, you know, whatever the inner child needed. Okay, let's do that. And then there was a few days in a row where I was meditating and I kept having these like weird sexual thoughts. And I was like, ew, like, no. And I'd like shut it down and like walk away, you know? And then one day I was like, okay, you know, I guess I just have to be brave. I have to see what's going on here. And that day I took a deep breath. I remember it so vividly. I took a deep breath. I breathed all the way out. And all of a sudden I remember these pieces, but of my sexual assault as a child. And that's pretty typical. But really what happened is that I had this searing pain shoot from my groin up through my body, and I was just nauseous and I wanted to vomit, and I shook and started crying, and it was nuts. So wow. I kind of was like, what the fuck was that, you know? And I thought
an understatement,
right? I thought oh, I gotta work on my abandonment issues, but visiting my inner child. So
I just think you're bipolar.
Yeah, right. Probably just it. Just throw some meds at that. So actually, I had already gotten this great therapist I was working through those issues with. And this woman who's a psychiatrist, but is an integrative psychiatrist. So she tries to do it naturally as much as possible, is also an MD, though, and knows how to manage the medication or whatever should I need it. Before I assumed, oh my God, I was sexually assaulted, I was like, doing my research online, repressed memories, blah, blah, blah. You know, there's in some ways repressed memories if they're being led. So there's been issues in the past where people will know that some guy they were associated with, for example, like had sexually assaulted a ton of people, and then they'll be in therapy and be like, I think he assaulted me too. Like that's a little bit different, right? Where you already heard this story about a person who I'm not saying they didn't, but being led is one of the things that is kind of like, a little more sketchy and repressed memories. However, we had not been discussing that at all. I thought it was abandonment issues because I felt like emotionally abandoned by my parents, you know, when I was little, they didn't have time for me, like that kind of thing. Boy, was I wrong. So I talked to both my therapist and my psychiatrist who kind of explained, you know, the amygdala is your emotional memory, right? Your amygdala stores these emotions that are associated with an event. When there's a traumatic event, if your stress level is just heightened a little bit, like for example, with physicians, when the ER, when I see horrific things like people who have beat their children to death, I remember that extremely vividly because my brain has upregulated my hippocampus to remember that event because it's stressful, but not stressful enough that my body is like shut it down, right? I remember this very vividly. So, however, when you cross that threshold into things that are so stressful that you don't want to remember, your hippocampus, the thing that remembers what happened, the facts, who it was, where it was, that kind of thing, shuts down. So you don't remember. And your amygdala, the emotional driver, that is the thing that keeps it going, that hijacks your body, that my body had been basically guided by for 35 years, you know, 30, yeah. No, so it was 34 years or, you know, 30 years. So basically my body was in the survival mode for 34 years and I didn't know why. And it, you know, the crazy thing, this might sound crazy. I'm not happy I was raped when I was a child. No, I mean, obviously, but it makes sense, right? It's like, oh my God, like that makes so much sense. And now I can use these beautiful modalities I've learned, you know, to help heal others, to help heal, you know, from other Indigenous peoples or other doctors or strong intuitives like myself, you know, to heal these wounds. And I have made probably, you know, 30 years of progress in 6 months because I'm now I can see the thing that I needed to show love to. Now I can see where we need some love.
A couple of questions. Does your body feel different now than it did before 6 months ago? And are you able to find peace around not getting to know more details, like who was it, where was I, et cetera, et cetera? Because I know for a lot of people, the fragmented memories is its own kind of torture because we want to be able to fully know our story.
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. You know, right now, my mom had alluded to something that I think I might know who it was. But the problem is that
I hope this was at Thanksgiving.
That she, brought,
that, she, that, that she brought this up.
Oh, right. No, no. And she didn't even. So just for context, when I had the attempted sexual assault in 2016, I couldn't tell my mom even the story without her like cracking a joke. I was like crying and then he took his pants off. I was trapped in my apartment. She's like, oh, did you say I've seen better? And that's her level of being able to talk about these things. So. Right. So we haven't really had a great discussion. There was some tiny thing she said that I'm like, maybe it was this guy, but maybe not, you know, and, you know, I thought about it. What would I do if I knew for sure it was him? I mean, absolutely. I would say, hey, like this guy might be doing this to other kids. Mm-hmm. I don't know where he is. I've tried to find him on Facebook to see, you know, I don't know. And again, I don't know who he is. And then I think about the attempted sexual assault in 2016, they wanted me to come testify in court and all this stuff. And, you know, I think that giving all of that time and attention to this person, if I could prove it and I knew it was him, let's make sure he's not doing this to other children, right? But I honestly do not think spending all this time and effort trying to figure out who it was for sure is going to help me remember, because you can't force a conscious memory. It's not going to help sitting and thinking about it. And B, it's taken away from all of this time and energy and effort that I could be using, honing my own healing, my own, you know, improvement, you know, my growth in life, my abilities to help others. Like think of how many people I can walk around helping, whether as a doctor or as a friend or as a random person, you know, that I can say, look, I've been there and let's heal together. Let's, you know, let's work through this together. I mean, how beautiful when you take, I don't know if people know that PTSD, like post-traumatic stress disorder, is not the only option. There's post-traumatic growth as well, is also a scientifically proven thing where
plasticity of the brain to be able to heal and rewire where the memories come from. Or
so that's part of it, but the big thing, the growth, is saying, yeah, this shitty thing happens to me, but I can't do anything about it except for use my experience to help another person. And that's where the growth comes in, is where we're using that to bring people together, to help heal others, to help find a way to say, yeah, I've been through that, but let me help you with that too. Let's take my hand. We're going to do this together.
And I think it's one of the most powerful things in the world. I had no idea it existed when I couldn't stop drinking, 17, 18 years ago. And until I experienced community and people sharing stories and helping each other and saying, I don't know how to do this, and breaking down and crying. I didn't know that that was not the end of my life. That was the beginning of my life, you know, the life I wanted to experience.
Right. Absolutely. And I think, you know, half of the battle is being open to a new experience, that the thing that you need for your growth and healing is coming to you, and you just need to be open and present and notice it. And maybe that's why, again, this is not perfect. Okay. Like, you know, when I was dating someone, my boyfriend and I just broke up. So, but it's, again, like on a very peaceful, a different level. Does that make mm-hmm. sense? A different kind of peaceful. Oh, I get it. It's not I'm being abandoned, you know? Like, okay, I see the lessons here and I appreciate that relationship, and now I'm ready to go on to whatever's next. But you know, a lot of times I think I'm mad at a person or a thing, or my job is burning me out or whatever. And then a lot of times, you know, I would be getting in an argument with him, and just by the end of the argument be crying, like, why would someone rape a child? And that was what I was mad at, you know? So it's that openness to both feel the feelings, to cry the tears, to be present with it, and to be vulnerable with the other people, instead of thinking you're mad at him for not calling an hour ago or what, you know, whatever you think you're mad at. It's really usually some bullshit from your past.
Yeah. So. There's a saying in recovery, if it's hysterical, it's historical.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Is there anything else you'd like to share before we wrap up?
Yeah, I think I just really want to emphasize how important it is people know the power of kind of their intuition for both. It's not just mental health. So when your heart is beating this more coherent pattern, your body's able to better heal. So blood is flowing better, wounds are healing, things like that. And really not to underestimate the power of, you know, stuck traumas, with your physical health. It's very important.
And I love too, that you've been able to highlight the relationship, between science and spirituality, which people often think of as two vastly different things. And I think they are one and the same.
Oh, agreed. Agreed. Yeah. If you have any questions, please reach out to me. I'm more than happy to explain it. I'm such a nerd about it. I read, obviously, scientific studies about it on my Friday nights. So,
and well, Rachel, give us the name of your book one more time, and we'll put a link to it in the show notes.
Okay. It's called Medication Detox, How to Live Your Best Health. And you can reach me on racheltaylormd.com. And I was very serious when I said any underserved population or organizations who just need this kind of information to be accessible to people that don't have very much accessibility to healthcare, let me know. I mean, I'm happy to volunteer my time.
Well, I appreciate what you do and being such an advocate and sharing your story. And I know the listeners do as well. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
Really enjoyed talking to her. This episode is sponsored by When Breath Becomes Air. When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi is the exquisitely observed memoir of an idealistic young neurosurgeon attempting to answer the question, what makes a life worth living, as he deals with his own terminal cancer diagnosis. It's a stunning reminder to live while we are alive. A must-read for anyone in medicine, from a doctor turned patient. For healthcare workers, expand your view on patient care and the fragile beauty of our mortal lives through Kalanithi's unforgettable words. Some of the questions Kalanithi wrestles with in this book include, what makes life worth living in the face of death? What do you do when the future flattens out into a perpetual present? When the future is no longer a ladder towards your goals in life? What does it mean to have a child, to nurture a new life as another fades away? When Breath Becomes Air is a number one New York Times bestseller, Pulitzer Prize finalist, and named one of the best books of the year by the New York Times Book Review, People, NPR, The Washington Post, Slate, and more. When Breath Becomes Air is available wherever books are sold. Learn more at prh.com/breath.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. now available on digital. Crow portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Let's dive into some surveys. This is from the Struggle in a Sentence survey filled out by a guy who calls himself Not Your Kind. And about his impulsive self-harm, he writes, I need to feel something, but if it doesn't leave a mark, I'm not doing it right. About his codependency, I will pull you down to the crushing depths where I have always lived, and you will have to leave to survive. Then I will return to the surface and just pop my head above the water enough to attract another to pull down with me. That sounds mischievous. Thank you for that. This is the same survey filled out by Cactus4000. And they write about their clinical depression, a happiness vacuum, taking away the good and leaving you with all the dust. Oh, that is such a good one. About their anorexia, a wispy voice trained to pick you apart. About their OCD, sort of like not playing with a pet when you're tired. You feel bad about not doing it, so you play with them. The pet ends up still wanting to play, and you're even more exhausted. Thank you for those. This is from the love survey filled out by Shannon. She writes, I love when my dog jumps up in my lap and presses her head down on my shoulder for a hug. I love the feeling of reading a book and having the pages and words disappear so there is only the mental movie of the story playing in my head. I love the way my husband supports me through the ups and downs of living with bipolar disorder. He is always patient and kind with me and has more than once been my reason to get the help I needed to keep going. I love the moment between sleep and wakefulness, when you are just starting or just finishing a dream, but can still feel your body relaxing. Oh, that is a great one. I love bundling up under blankets in cold weather and feeling the coziness. I love when you briefly half wake up from a good dream or an unfinished dream, and you're able to fall back asleep and recapture it. Get right back in place. This is from the love survey filled out by Dufresne Party of Two. For those of you that aren't familiar with that, that's a bit that Mitch Hedberg did, the late comedian Mitch Hedberg. Probably one of my favorite bits that he did. And they write their loves. A good night of rest, not just sleep, but a restful night where you wake up and you actually feel ready to take on the day. The little rubbery toe beans out of my cat. The peace and solitude that only sitting in your car in an empty parking lot can bring. Oh, that is such a good one. A difficult but healing therapy appointment. One where I struggle through every sentence but walk away feeling like an absolute badass. King crab legs, Old Bay, butter, and permission to be a savage for the meal. Ice skating in an empty arena, pre-pandemic. Pre-pandemic, I would sometimes take a day off of work to go to an open skate. I would go at 10 a.m. on a weekday when there was no one there. I can't play hockey anymore because of an injury, but putting on my old skates and stepping out onto the untouched ice is still incredible. It's like entering another world. I can hear the cut of the blade in the ice and every stride. The creaking of the old worn skate boot as I turn a corner. The weightlessness and power. Some days there is nothing better. Boy, do I agree with that one. This is an awfulsome moment filled out by a woman who calls herself Gray Hairs at 24. And she writes, a couple of years ago, I was picking up sushi to eat with my family. I had my hair up, glasses on, and was smiling at a cute animal picture on my phone as I was walking out of the restaurant with the food. As the door closes behind me, a homeless man shouts at me from 5 feet away, you're so fucking ugly, I hope you kill yourself tonight. Not wanting to provoke him, I quietly said, okay, and quietly walked to my car. Even though logically I know I shouldn't pay any mind to something like that, it makes me wonder if that's what people who are sober also think when they see me but are too sane to say aloud. How sad is that? That is the definition of awesome, awfulsome. I hope at least the sushi was good. This is from the Shame and Secret survey. This was filled out by a guy who calls himself Still Mad 20 years later. He is straight, in his 20s, raised in a slightly dysfunctional environment, was the victim of sexual abuse and never reported it. He writes, molested and used as a vessel of sexual exploration by an older female cousin who lived in our house. I was around 5 or 6 and she was around 11 or 12. I grew up with some real rage issues and undiagnosed anxiety that I didn't recognize until later in life. I felt ashamed and powerless and confused. I've ever been physically or emotionally abused. I was spanked a lot as a, and he writes, not sure. I was spanked a lot as a kid up until 14 years old. Dad was a good guy, but a very powerful and intimidating person who yelled often. Any positive experiences with the abusers? Not really. Deepest, darkest thoughts. There have been incest fantasies, no doubt caused by all this. Some suicidal ideation in the past. Lots of impulsive thoughts. I've been at times terrified of being around kids because violent or abusive thoughts will come into my head. Not that I want to do those things, but it's more like my brain flashing the worst possible moves into my head. It is very distressing when it happens. And I have had, first of all, I want to say how sorry I am that you had to experience that. And many people also experience that stress of, you know, the brain playing the unpleasant animation festival of images. And, you know, it's kind of like that thing when you're on the roof of a building and you're like, what if I jump against my will? What if my body just takes over? Darkest secrets. I still can't bear to tell my parents that my cousin also involved my baby sister in sexual acts at least once. What if anything, and he doesn't list any sexual fantasies. I guess he kind of did in the darkest thoughts section. What if anything would you like to say to someone you haven't been able to? I want to ask my parents why they are still in contact with the person who did this to me. So they must know that it happened to you, just not to your baby sister. What, if anything, do you wish for? Closure. Man, I think a support group would be such a great place for you to begin to get some closure, because there is nothing like being around a group of people that know what you're feeling and who have the experience to help you navigate that. You know, the first time I walked into one of my support group meetings, you know, I'd felt my whole life like a three-legged dog and just always like, you know, oh, nobody is as fucked up as I am. And I walked into this meeting and within a half hour, just hearing various people share, I was like, oh my God, I am in a room filled with three-legged dogs. Have you shared these things with others? Yes. I first told a female friend of mine when I was 13 or 14. She had confided in me that she was violently raped and I could no longer keep silent about what happened to me. I told a couple friends later on, and unfortunately one of my friends got drunk at a party and said to me, come on, man, have a drink. You already got fucked by your cousin when you were a kid. Wow. Wow. That took a long time to get over. He's still my friend and a good guy, although very misguided and socially awkward back then, but I'll never forget that. How do you feel after writing these things down? Not sure. Is there anything you'd like to share with someone who shares your thoughts or experiences? Try to find peace. I haven't, but trying has brought me to a lot of self-improvement over the years. Thank you for filling that out. This is also from the Shame and Secret survey filled out by Faye. She identifies as bisexual. She's in her 30s, was raised in a totally chaotic environment, was the victim of sexual abuse and never reported it. When I was 10 or 11, it was by a male babysitter who was in his 20s and in college. My dad and stepmom hired him often, even though I was only around every other weekend, to watch my four younger brothers because they were little assholes and wouldn't listen to me. I babysat all the time for other people. He wanted to play, quote, house with me, being the mom. No penetration, just dry humping and a lot of fondling. I was a seriously sheltered and extremely developed little girl. I wore a C-cup bra at 10. I honestly believed he wanted to be my boyfriend. I was so ashamed because he gave me my first orgasm. I thought I was a very bad person. I never told anyone. When I was 16 at my first job, an older coworker and I were closing up. He was in the back. I went back to drop off the drawer and cash register printout. Long story short, I ended up being physically forced to give him a hand job. The next day, he wasn't scheduled to work, but came in anyway with a group of five other men. I'm 5'2". The only other person was a boy, also 16, and busy helping a customer in the front while I was working in the back. They surrounded me and taunted me. I was a sexy little slut. I was going to suck them all off and let them all fuck me, etc., etc. I ran when the other guy from the front came back after the customer left. I was fired for walking out of work after I told my boss the story. Wow. Wow. I can't imagine how difficult it must be for you to walk through the world and trust people and to feel safe. She's also been emotionally abused. Lifetime of abuse, stepdad mostly, made me and my brother fall in love with him, then crushed us. He started calling me a stupid little cunt at 8 and kicked me out at 16 when my mom got preggo with his kid. I wasn't welcome in his family. That's just a snapshot. Any positive experiences with the abusers? Absolutely. When his kids would visit, he was so much fun. Campfires and ice skating on the pond in our backyard. He made toboggan runs down the hill. Helped us build tree forts in the woods. Until they left. Then he started drinking. ... That had to be a real mind fuck too, the fact that he wasn't that way when they weren't around. I mean, how deeply must that have sent the message that you weren't worthy of love or attention? Darkest thoughts. I want to run away from my family, husband of 17 years, and kids, 18, 16, and 5. I want to run away with them if they would come, but I doubt they would. Well, that one's interesting because normally when people want to run away, they want to run away from the spouse and the kids. Darkest secrets. I used to experiment with my female cousin who was younger than me. I hope I didn't abuse her. She is 2 years younger. She said we were being gay and never wanted to play again. I never asked or pressed after that. I also experimented with friends, two girls in particular. Again, the minute they felt weird, we stopped. I was in love with Emily in middle school. Broke my heart when she didn't want to let me touch her anymore. Sexual fantasy is most powerful to you. Being with a woman, as in a real relationship out in the real world, it makes me want to cry because I'm not strong enough to try. What, if anything, would you like to say to someone you haven't been able to? I hate my stepdad. Hate him. That's in caps. Even now, with my wonderful sister starting her own family, I have to smile and pretend that asshole didn't ruin my life. I have to suck it up for her. That's her dad, and I love her so much. What, if anything, do you wish for? I wish my kids didn't need me so much. The two oldest are autistic, so that I could leave my comfortable and stable marriage, and those are both in quotes. It's just so damn ... easy. Have you shared these things with others? I shared how I feel about the stepdad with my mom. She's so codependent. I'm her therapist. I hate it, and I can't say no when she wants to talk about it. I guess I'm codependent too. That is definitely a sign of codependence, and that might be a great place for you to check out a support group, because a lot of stuff can get unraveled in codependence support groups, because they really focus on setting boundaries and sticking to them, identifying what it is that you want, and giving you tools to go about caring for yourself and practicing self-care and starting to live the life that you want to live. How do you feel after writing these things down? Like I'm a giant piece of crazy. Like I'm whining. You are not whining. Like I should just stop because so many people have it worse than me. No, it's not a contest. Suck it up, buttercup. You know, that's the people that say suck it up, you know, man up. I just want to say fuck you, first of all. And, you know, those are usually the people that call people snowflake or say that you're afraid. To which I would say, actually, you're the ones that are afraid. You're afraid to open the door to what it is you're feeling, to share what's going on in your head. You're the one that's running. This person wants to stop and face what they've been running from. That's bravery. What, if anything, would you like to share with someone who shares your thoughts or experiences? I wish I had advice. I'm not the person anyone should listen to. Thank you for sharing that, Faye. Yeah, I really hope you can find some way to carve out the life that you want. Because we all, you know, it sounds cliche, but we all deserve to find our authentic selves. And finally, these are some loves from Windowsill Veronica. And she writes, I love standing by the sea or ocean and staring at the waves in any weather. It's like the sea wind blows all trouble from my mind and quiets it. Yeah, that is a great one. I've always been fascinated by the ocean and waves. It is just so mesmerizing to me. You know, I've seen the Grand Canyon and a lot of other cool shit in my life, but nothing compares to being on the beach at the Banzai Pipeline on Oahu in the winter when the surf was 18 feet and watching people, you know, 40 yards away just drop into bombs. You know, there was one guy, before I even got to the beach, I asked somebody, hey, where's Banzai Pipeline exactly? And this guy laughed and said, right by that dude waiting for the ambulance. And there was this guy standing there that had gotten raked over the coral. Because there's only about 2 feet of water between the surface and the rock-hard, razor-sharp bed of coral. So if you wipe out, not only are you getting crushed by those gigantic waves, but you're getting raked over razor blades, and this guy was just bleeding from head to toe. Anyway, I love that. Adorable big wet snouts of huge dogs. Watching hot air balloons pass over the old town of my former home city on a beautiful summer evening. Oh, I love this one. Large snowflakes falling quietly in the night, blanketing the world with whiteness. That first cafe stop on holidays when you sit down, order a drink, and know you have an amazing week ahead of you. An afternoon on my own in a bar with a beer and a good book. Not hating the sight of yourself in a group selfie. Well, look at you, all full of yourself. Not hating yourself like the rest of us. Medieval cities and old towns where every step feels surrounded by history and you can feel generations that have gone before you. Laughing fits with a friend where you both cannot breathe or talk. Freshly baked bread. I love that one. I started baking bread, which I've had to take a break from because I had to cut white flour out of my diet. And I love just pulling them out of the oven and then set them on a cooling rack, and they, for like a half hour, you can hear them crackle. Oh, so good. Paddling around a quiet lake in a small, old-school wooden boat, listening to the evening birds settling down and seeing the sky turn purple. Christmas around a large table full of people. chancing upon a perfect present for someone. Taking the time to perfectly gift wrap something so that the wrapping is so beautiful it becomes an additional present. That was the last one. And that's a great one. And I can honestly say I have never wrapped a gift well. And there's always this anxiety that the person is going to go to open it and go, what the fuck? Do you even care about me? They just throw the gift at me. Anyway, I hope you got something out of today's episode. And I hope if you're struggling that you know you're not alone. And help is always out there if we're willing to get out of our comfort zone and ask for it. And you're not alone. And thanks for listening.
Everybody I know is bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up
I know
in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully fucked up in some weird way.